10-3801 Sanchez versus City of Chicago. Hi, Mr. Cerda. Come on up.
May it please the court. Plaintiff's case was largely a failure to intervene case. At trial, plaintiff introduced evidence that after he was unreasonably detained in the early morning hours, he was handcuffed, shoved toward the mouth of an alley, flipped face forward into the concrete, and then beaten. He introduced testimony that the defendant, Peterson, was arm length to the side or just behind him. He also testified, and other witness testifies, that defendant Caballero was off to the side but was not involved in the excessive force. There was no suggestion anywhere that this was a case of supervisory liability where a supervisory liability instruction was given. Because
it was litigated on a respondeat superior theory with respect to the state law claims.
The state law claims were dismissed.
None of them went to trial?
None of them went to the jury.
Okay. So, they were litigated, though, but not sent to the jury. They were dismissed at the conclusion of the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. They were dismissed perhaps even before the conclusion of the evidence. They were dismissed the morning that the case went to the jury.
So this would be the battery claim and the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim?
Yes. As I recall, they were dismissed the morning of the last
Wasn't
day of the trial.
Wasn't there testimony to support both claims?
There was, Your Honor. Litigation reasons to avoid post-trial briefing on that matter because we felt the failure to intervene and a claim was so strong, we dismissed those claims.
So that was a voluntary dismissal?
Voluntary dismissal of the state law claims was made the morning of the last day of trial.
Okay, so not on a motion of the defense.
Correct, Your Honor. I warned the trial court. Yes.
Was that because of the pretrial rulings having to do with the unidentified officers?
Yes, Your Honor, and that, I think, has led to some confusion with the actual failure to intervene instruction that was given.
Sure.
Because we have two problems. The first problem is that the supervisory instruction that was given states that you may not hold the two named defendants liable for the conduct or misconduct of other officers. Prior to that, there was an allegation there were other officers and unnamed officers involved under the state law claims. So because the supervisory liability instruction was given, it negated the failure to intervene instruction.
Right.
Because it says you may not hold them liable. And the first paragraph, now looking at this more closely, the first paragraph of the failure to intervene instruction that was given is incorrect as a matter of law, because it requires that you find either the defendants falsely detained or use excessive force. We had separate direct claims for failure to detention against both of the defendants. We only had one. We did not have an excessive force claim against defendant Caballero at all, because we conceded that was not you.
Why wouldn't the jury have understood that the failure to intervene is a form of personal involvement, given the strength of your closing argument?
They couldn't, because the supervisory instructed them that they may not hold the defendants liable. We tried to modify that with an additional line stating that failure to intervene may constitute personal involvement. We tried to correct it, and that modification was rejected by the court.
Well, the problem would have been solved by giving the instructions in a different order.
They both would have stood, the same language would have been there, that you may not hold the defendant, two defendants, named defendants, Peterson and Caballero, liable for the acts of other employees. That's squarely in opposition to the failure to intervene instruction.
Right.
We could not win.
The personal involvement instruction was legally correct.
It's misplaced because there's no...
The two instructions weren't facially inconsistent. And, you know, as I just noted, your ability to harmonize the two instructions in your closing argument, it seems to me, took care of any problem that might have been presented.
But I'm not the person who instructs the jury, Your Honor. The judge instructs the jury, and the instructions he gave him prevented plaintiff from winning. We could not win given the written instructions provided to the jury. It was not possible.
And this judge's practice is to instruct following closing arguments?
Yes.
And he did so in this case?
Yes. Yes, I believe that, yes. Because judges do it differently. To my recollection, Judge Jarrett instructed them after closing arguments.
And the problem could have been solved not only by giving the instructions in the proper order, which is to say that the personal involvement instruction, which was legally correct, would follow the substantive instructions on false arrest and excessive force, and then the failure to intervene instruction would come next in the order of instructions bridged by a however clause or some other bridging language as recommended by the notes to the pattern instructions.
But our first point is that there was no reason to give the personal liability instruction at all because it was confusing. This is not a question. It's given when there's potential for misplaced supervisory liability. That's not the question here. That did not develop at trial at all.
Let me tell you what, I think that given the jury's rejection of the unlawful detention and excessive force claims, it's very difficult to see how the plaintiffs were prejudiced by any potential confusion, as to the interaction between the two.
We were
a very hard time with that.
Well, we could win the failure to intervene without winning the excessive force or unlawful detention claims. And we lost, the other claims because of a number of other prejudicial errors, including the admission of expert opinion, evidence about prior fighting gangs, and prior arrests. That the defendants...
You really are arguing that Killen provided expert testimony.
We submitted.
I'm sorry.
We squarely did. He said, was there the question to him proposed by the court to get it in, ask Investigator Killian, did you find any evidence to substantiate his claims? He wasn't asked who said what photograph was taken. He was asked to give an opinion about, number one, what the evidence was, and number two, whether, in his opinion, he thought that it was substantiated. And that's squarely an expert.
He was simply testifying from personal knowledge as to what he did or didn't find. And it was on a discrete collateral issue to boot.
Actually, it seeped in other ways because we had evidence that that he conducted an investigation not about the ancillary post-incident issue, but he interviewed the defendants themselves concerning the incident where they gave a different testimony about why they filled out contact cards. So the jury was aware that he conducted an investigation not just of the incident, just of the post-trial incident involving the double hearsay issue, but he interviewed both of the individual defendants. So they knew in their mind that he conducted an investigation of the entire thing. I perhaps should reserve that.
Okay. Ms. Back.
Yeah. May it please the court. In the early morning hours of April 5th, 2008, officers Caballero and Peterson observed Efren and Jose Sanchez fighting in the street outside of Jose's house. The officers stopped the men, cuffed them, and performed a protective pat-down, and ultimately let them go after determining that that they were brothers and the fight was not serious. Sanchez maintained, on the other hand, that he sustained his injuries when the officers violently assaulted him. After a week-long trial involving the testimony of numerous eyewitnesses to the incident, the jury found for the officers on all claims. Sanchez presents no reason to overturn that verdict today. This morning I intend to address the jury instruction issue and the testimony of Inspector Killen. Of course, I welcome questions on any issues that were raised in the briefs. First, I'd like to begin by clarifying a point on the jury instruction, which I think probably would have been clear had they raised the supervisory issue in their opening brief. Unfortunately, that wasn't raised until their reply brief, so we didn't have a chance to address it, but I think it's actually just a matter of confusion that's very easy to resolve. This simply wasn't a supervisory instruction, and the court can see that if you compare Pattern Instruction 7.02 concerning personal responsibility, which was given in this case, and Pattern Instruction 7.17, which concerns supervisory liability, which was not given in this case. Those are two separate instructions, and I think they're just a little confused as to perhaps which instruction was given. Pattern Instruction 7.02 concerning personal responsibility makes no mention that it needs to have any sort of supervisory involvement in order to be given, nor do the cases that they cite.
But it does require some integrating supplementary language when it is given with the failure to intervene claim.
That, I believe Your Honor is referencing the comment, which indicates that the court may wish to do so. It's certainly not required. It was certainly not asked for by the other side. The other side asked for a modification, but not the one specified in the comment to which Your Honor is referring.
Well, the modification that was requested is coextensive with the comment's suggestion about how these instructions ought to be used.
I agree that there
is a basis for confusion, jury confusion, without that bridging explanation.
Right, in which case I would refer back to that, again, the comment says that the court may give it, and here when the court looked at the language, it felt that the language clarified the situation, because the personal involvement instruction says that the defendants must be involved, personally involved, in the conduct that plaintiff alleges.
Right. And the problem is giving that instruction immediately after the failure to intervene instruction tends to negate the failure to intervene theory as a matter of law. That's why there's a need for some clarification. And particularly after, if the judge instructs after closing arguments as opposed to before closing arguments, it's better practice to instruct before closing arguments, so that the jury has a framework of the law within which to place the arguments and counsel can address how the facts relate to the law that the jury has just heard. When the judge instructs after closing arguments, there's a heightened potential for jury confusion.
My response to that would be twofold. The first is, as you pointed out, opposing counsel did have the opportunity to clarify in his closing argument that the officers need not have been involved, personally involved in the underlying conduct in order to be found guilty.
Right, but the judge is going to hear something to the contrary, the jury is going to hear something to the contrary from the judge after the arguments are done.
Correct.
And the jury is also going to hear from the judge that whatever counsel says, you should disregard if it conflicts with what I'm about to say.
That's right. My argument, like I said, is twofold. The first is that the jury did have some indication, albeit not as clear as Your Honor would have liked, that there was...
And there were a lot of atmospherics in this trial, as far as I can tell, about this whole issue of the unidentified officers, and some of that played out in front of the jury. Did it not?
I'm not sure to what Your Honor is referring.
There was much discussion, both on and off the record, in front of the jury and outside the jury's presence, of the issue of the unidentified officers. And so the jury's antenna were up in terms of how trials actually play out.
Sure. Truthfully, I don't know to what Your Honor is referring. My reading of the transcript, it appeared that the sidebars were, in fact, truly sidebars when they talked about the evidentiary questions. The other thing that I would emphasize here is that even if there was confusion, there is certainly no prejudice, because the failure to intervene instruction made liability contingent upon the officers being found guilty on the other two counts. I found it interesting.
I don't think so.
It absolutely did. The first element of the failure to intervene instruction.
At least the potential for liability for failure to intervene if one of the unidentified officers conducted the beating.
That's not how the jury was instructed.
But that's a mistake.
Which they have not raised. It's just totally waived. They didn't raise it in their opening brief or their reply brief.
They were foreclosed from putting this theory in erroneously from the get-go because the district court misunderstood both the failure to intervene theory in this case and the respondeat superior liability theory on the state law claims.
I would disagree again. First, the court correctly ruled that unnamed officers cannot be defendants in a trial where there had neither been
served. That's not the point. The judge made a mistake in that regard. It's not whether they were defendants. It's whether their actions could be a basis for liability on the federal claims on a failure to intervene theory against these two officers
and
against the city on a respondeat superior theory against involving the conduct of the unidentified officers on the state law theories.
And my response is twofold. First, the court didn't preclude any of that evidence from coming in. There was lots and lots of testimony from both Efren, Jose, Valerie Rodriguez, Maria Rodriguez, Valerie Rodriguez and Maria Sanchez, all about the conduct of the unidentified officers. In addition, the instruction, the personal involvement, or pardon me, the failure to intervene jury instruction was proposed by Sanchez. He never proposed an instruction that linked it to the unidentified officers. So the court didn't prevent him from doing that. That was something that he did of his own volition, regardless of whether he regrets it now or not. It wasn't something that he attempted to do or that the court prevented him from doing.
What was the import of the discussion in limine then about foreclosing any litigation of a theory having to do with the unidentified officers' conduct?
That they couldn't be named as defendants. The plaintiff wanted to name...
They hadn't been named as defendants.
But that... And that
so
was
there
the
was
problem.
No, there was no personal liability on the part of unidentified officers that was going to be proposed to the jury. What was proposed is that the city was liable for the conduct of unidentified officers on the state law claims on a respondeat superior theory, which should have been submitted to the jury as, the city's liability for the actions of John Doe officers. That's how it's done in these cases. As to the failure to intervene theory, that these two officers could be found liable for failure to intervene to prevent the constitutional misconduct of unidentified officers.
My understanding,
that's how these claims should have been constructed and presented to the jury from the get-go. And there's an awful lot of confusion in the record about how the judge viewed the case.
I don't disagree with Your Honor's legal theory, but in this case, I believe the plaintiffs wanted to present an excessive force and unreasonable detention claims against the unnamed officers. I think that was the problem here, and I think a review of the record will make that clear.
My reading of the record is that everybody was talking past each other. The plaintiff's attorney was being cut off at the pass from attempting to make a record about what the theory really was because the judge wasn't having any of it.
I think plaintiffs have a very skilled attorney in making the record appear that way. I would also point out that when you look at the amended complaints, they never take the unidentified officers out as defendants. So that would be further evidence that they actually thought that those people could personally be defendants. The court has no further questions.
Thank you.
We'd ask them to affirm.
Mr. Cerda, how much time? 1 minute.
Your Honor is quite correct. There was much discussion about unidentified defendants. The defendants' testimony that they were the only officers on the scene, they would admit who handcuffed them. We placed six officers on the scene. We had the state law claims that we're going to bring them in on respondeat superior under state law, not under federal law. We didn't have unknown defendants as defendants on the excessive force claim.
Did you make clear to the district court that your theory of liability with respect to the unidentified officers was not that they were in the case?
No, it's a state law, the respondeat superior. Mm-hmm. But we had a problem, and we didn't. We thought that it would be, at that point, we're frustrated, and so we cut out the state law claims because we saw foresaw problems in post-trial motions, and we had the I think we had a solid failure to intervene claim. And if we were mistaken with regard to the instruction given, it still is wrong as a matter of law and should have been corrected by the court if it was not corrected by us.
You dropped the ball.
Okay.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you.